Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 182nd of the Cthulhu Podcast. I'm FNH. Today, we're starting off with the next part of Greenmantle, then we'll have a musical number from way back in 1921, and then on to the second part of HBR. Let's get started. Chapter 3. Peter Pinar. Our various departures were unassuming, all but the Americans. Sandy spent a busy fortnight in his subterranean fashion, now in the British Museum, now running about the country to see old exploring companions, and now at the War Office, and now at the Foreign Office, but mostly in my flat, sunk into an armchair and meditating. He finally left on December 1st as a King's Messenger for Cairo. Once there, I knew the King's Messenger would disappear, and some queer Oriental ruffian take his place. It would have been impertinence in me to inquire into his plans. He was the real professional, and I was only the dabbler. Blenkinron was a different matter. Sir Walter told me to look out for squalls, and the twinkle in his eye gave me a notion of what was coming. The first thing the sportsman did was to write a letter to the papers signed with his name. There had been a debate in the House of Commons on foreign policy, and the speech of some idiot there gave him his cue. He declared that he had been heart and soul with the British at the start, but that he was reluctantly compelled to change his views. He said our blockade of Germany had broken all the laws of God and humanity, and he reckoned that Britain was now the worst exponent of the Prussianism going. That letter made a fine racket, and the paper that printed it had a row with the censor. But that was only the beginning of Mr. Blenkiron's campaign. He got mixed up with some mountebanks called the League of Democrats Against Aggression, gentlemen who thought that Germany was all right if we could only keep from hurting her feelings. He addressed a meeting under their auspices, which was broken up by the crowd, but not before John Ayres had got off his chest a lot of amazing stuff. I wasn't there, but a man who was told me that he never heard such clotted nonsense. He said that Germany was right in wanting the freedom of the seas, and that America would back her up, and that the British Navy was a bigger menace to the peace of the world than the Kaiser's army. He admitted that he had once thought differently, but he was an honest man, and now not afraid of the facts. The oration closed suddenly when he got a Brussels sprout in the eye, at which my friend said he swore in a very unpacifistic style. After that, he wrote other letters to the press, saying that there was no more liberty of speech in England, and a lot of scallywags backed him up. The Americans wanted to tar and feather him, and he got kicked out of the Savoy. There was an agitation to get him deported, and questions were asked in Parliament, and the Under Secretary for Foreign Affairs said his department had the matter in hand. I was beginning to think that Blenkiron was carrying his tomfoolery too far, so I went to see Sir Walter, but he told me to keep my mind easy. Our friend's motto is thorough, he said, and he knows very well what he's about. We have officially requested him to leave, and he sails from Newcastle on Monday. He will be shadowed wherever he goes, and we hope to provoke some outbreaks. He is a very capable fellow. The last I saw of him was on Saturday afternoon when I met him in St. James's Street and offered to shake hands. He told me that my uniform was a pollution and made a speech to a small crowd about it. They hissed him, and he had to get into a taxi. As he departed, there was just the suspicion of a wink in his left eye. On Monday I read that he had gone off, and the papers observed that our shores were well quit of him. I sailed on December 3rd from Liverpool in a boat bound for the Argentine that was due to put in at Lisbon. I had, of course, to get a Foreign Office passport to leave England, but after that my connection with the government ceased. All the details of my journey were carefully thought out. Lisbon would be a good jumping-off place, for it was a rendezvous of scallywags from most parts of Africa. My kit was an old Gladstone bag, and my clothes were the relics of my South African wardrobe. I let my beard grow for some days before I sailed, and since it grows fast, I went on board with the kind of hairy chin you will see on a young boar. My name was now Brandt, Cornelius Brandt, at least so my passport said, and my passport never lies. There were just two other passengers on that beastly boat, and they never appeared until we were out of the bay. I was pretty bad myself, but managed to move about all the time, for the frost in my cabin would have sickened a hippo. The old tub took 2 days and a night to waddle from Ushant to Finisterre. Then the weather changed and we came out of snow squalls into something like summer. The hills of Portugal were all blue and yellow, like the Kalahari, and before we made the Tagus I was beginning to forget I had ever left Rhodesia. There was a Dutchman amongst the sailors whom I used to patter the Taal, but for good morning and for good evening in broken English to the captain. That was about all the talking I did on the cruise. We dropped anchor off the quays of Lisbon on a shiny blue morning pretty near warm enough to wear flannels. I'd now got to be very wary. I did not leave the ship with a shore-going boat, but made a leisurely breakfast. Then I strolled on deck, and there, just casting anchor in the middle of the stream, was another ship with a blue and white funnel I knew so well. I calculated that a month before, she'd been smelling the mangrove swamps of Angola. Nothing could be better to answer for my purpose. I proposed to board her, pretending I was looking for a friend and come on shore from her, so that anyone in Lisbon who chose to be curious would think I had landed straight from Portuguese Africa. I hailed one of the adjacent ruffians and got into his rowboat with my kit. We reached the vessel, they called her the Henry the Navigator, just as the first shore boat was leaving. The crowd in it were all Portuguese, which suited my book. But when I went up the ladder, the first man I met was old Peter Pinar. He was a piece of sheer monumental luck. Peter had opened his eyes and his mouth and got as far as Alamchtik when I shut him up. Brandt, I said. Cornelius Brandt. That's my name now, and don't you forget it. Who's the captain here? Is it still old Sloggett? Yeah, said Peter, pulling himself together. He was speaking about you yesterday. This was better and better. I had sent Peter below to get hold of Sloggett, and presently I had a few words with that gentleman in his old cabin with the door shut. You've got to enter my name in the ship's books. I came aboard at Mossandis, and my name is Cornelius Brandt. At first Sloggett was for objecting. He said it was a felony. I told him that I dared say it was, but he had got to do it, for reasons which I couldn't give, but which were highly creditable to all parties. In the end he agreed, and I saw it done. I had to pull on old Sloggett, for I'd known him ever since he owned a dissolute tugboat at Delagoa Bay. Then Peter and I went ashore and swaggered into Lisbon as if we owned De Beers. We put up at the big hotel opposite the railway station, and looked and behaved like a pair of low-bred South Africans home for a spree. It was a fine, bright day, so I hired a motor car and said I would drive it myself. We asked the name of some beauty spot to visit, and were told Sintra, and shown the road to it. I wanted a quiet place to talk, for I had a good deal to say to Peter Pinar. I christened that car the Lusitanian Terror, and it was a marvel that we did not smash ourselves up. There was something immortally wrong with its steering gear. Half a dozen times we slewed across the road, inviting destruction. But we got there in the end, and had luncheon in a hotel opposite the Moorish Palace. There we left the car, and wandered up the slopes of a hill where, sitting amongst the scrub, very like the veld, I told Peter the situation of affairs. But first a word must be said about Peter. He was the man that taught me all I ever knew of veldcraft, and a good deal about human nature besides. He was out of the old colony, Burgersdrop, I think, but he had come to Transvaal when the Lindbergh goldfield started. He was a prospector, transport rider, and a hunter in turns, but principally a hunter. In those early days he was none too good a citizen. He was in Swaziland with Bob McNab, and you know what that means. But then he took to working off bogus gold propositions on Kimberley and Johannesburg magnates, and what he didn't know about salting a mine wasn't knowledge. After that, he was in the Kalahari, where he and Scotty Smith were familiar names, An era of comparative respectability dawned for him with the Matabele War, when he did uncommon good scouting and transport work. Cecil Rhodes wanted to establish him on a stock farm down Salisbury way, but Peter was an independent devil and would call no man his master. He took to big game hunting, which was what God intended for him, for he could track a tressabee in a thick bush and was far the finest shot I've ever seen in my life. He took parties to the Pungi Flats and to the Barotsland and up to the Tanganyika, and then he made a speciality of the Ngami region, where I once hunted with him and he was with me when I went prospecting in Damaraland. When the Boer War started, Peter, like many of the very great hunters, took the British side and did most of our intelligence work in the North Transvaal. Beyers would have hanged him if he could have caught him, and there was no love lost between Peter and his own people for many a day. When it was all over, and things had calmed down a bit, he settled in Bulawayo, and used to go with me when I went on a trek. At the time when I left Africa 2 years before, I'd lost sight of him for months, and heard that he was somewhere on the Congo poaching elephants. It always a great idea of making things hum so loud in Angola that the Union government would have to step in and annex it. After Rhodes, Peter had the biggest notions south of the line. He was a man of about 5'10", very thin and active, and as strong as a buffalo. He had pale blue eyes, a face as gentle as a girl's, and a soft, sleepy voice. From his present appearance, it looked as if he'd been living hard lately. His clothes were of the cut you might expect to get at Lobito Bay. He was as lean as a rake, deeply browned with the sun, and there was a lot of grey in his beard. He was 56 years old and used to be taken for 40. Now he looked about his age. I first asked him what he'd been up to since the war began. He spat in the Kaffir way he had, and he said he'd been having hell's time. "I got hung up on the Kefu," he said. "When I heard from old Lesatella that the white men were fighting, I had a bright idea that I might get into the German southwest from the north. You see, I knew that Botha couldn't long keep out of the war. Well, I got into German territory all right, and then into Skellum of an officer came along and commandeered all my mules and wanted to commandeer me with them for his fool's army. He was a very ugly man with a yellow face." Peter filled a deep pipe from a kudu skin pouch. "Were you commandeered?" I asked. "No, I shot him. Not so much as to kill, but to wound badly. It was all right, for he fired first on me. Got me too in the left shoulder, but that was the beginning of bad trouble. I trekked east pretty fast and got over the border amongst the Yovamba. I've made many journeys, but that was the worst. 4 days I went without water and 6 without food. And then by bad luck I fell in with Nikitla. You remember the half-caste chief? He said I owed him money for cattle which I brought when I came there with Karawab. It was a lie, but he held to it and would give me no transport. So I crossed the Kalahari on my feet. It was slow. Avrua coming on from Nachmal. It took me weeks and weeks, and when I came to Lechevi's kraal, I heard that the fighting was over and that Botha had conquered the Germans. That too was a lie, but it deceived me, and I went north into Rhodesia, where I learned the truth. But by then, I judged the war had gone too far for me to make any profit out of it, so I went into Angola to look for German refugees. By that time, I was hating Germans worse than hell. But what did you propose to do with them? I asked. I had a notion they'd make trouble with the government in those parts. I don't specially love the Portuguese, but I'm for him against the Germans every day. Well, there was trouble, and I had a merry time for a month or two. But by and by it petered out, and I thought I'd the better clear out for Europe, for South Africa was setting down just as the big show was getting really interesting. So here I am, Cornelius, my old friend. If I shave my beard, will they let me join the Flying Corps? I looked at Peter, sitting there, smoking, as imperturbable as if he had been growing mealies in Natal all his life and had run home for a month's holiday with his people in Peckham. "You're coming with me, my lad," I said. "We're going to Germany." Peter showed no surprise. "Keep in mind that I don't like the Germans," was all he said. "I'm a quiet Christian man, and I've a devil of a temper, Then I told him the story of our mission. "You and I have got to be Moretz's men. We went into Angola and now we're trekking for the fatherland to get a bit of our own back from the infernal English. Neither of us knows any German publicly. We'd better plan out the fighting we were in. Kakamas will do for one, and Shuit Drift. You were a Ngamiland hunter before the war. They don't have your dossier, so you can tell any lie you like. I'd better be an educated Afrikander, one of the Bayer's bright lads, and a pal of old Herzog. We can let our imaginations loose about that part, but we must stick to the same yarn about the fighting."
"Ja, Cornelius," said Peter.
He'd called me Cornelius ever since I told him my new name. He was a wonderful chap for catching on to any game. "But after we get into Germany, what then? There can't be much difficulty about the beginning, but once we're amongst the beer swillers, I don't quite see our line. We're to find out about something that's going on in Turkey? When I was a boy, the Predikant used to preach about Turkey. I wish I was better educated and remembered whereabouts in the map it was."
"You leave that to me," I said. "I'll explain it all to you before we get there. We haven't got much of a spoor, but we'll cast about, and with luck we'll pick it up. I've seen you do it often enough when we hunted kudu on the Kafu."
Peter nodded. "Do we sit still in a German town?" he asked anxiously.
"I shouldn't like that, Cornelius."
"We move gently eastward, to Constantinople," I said.
Peter grinned. "We should cover a lot of new country. You can reckon on me, friend Cornelius. I've always had a hankering to see Europe."
He rose to his feet and stretched his long arms.
"We'd better begin at once. God, I wonder what's happened to old Solly Maritz with his bottle face. Yon was a fine battle at the Drift when I was sitting up to my neck in the Orange praying that Brits lads would take my head for a stone."
Peter was as thorough a mountebank when he got started as Blenkiron himself. All the way back to Lisbon he yarned about Maritz and his adventures in German Southwest until I half believed they were true. He made a very good story of our doings, and by his constant harping on it, I pretty soon got it into my memory. That was always Peter's way. He said if you were going to play a part, you must think yourself into it. Convince yourself that you were it until you really were it and didn't act but behaved naturally. The two men who had started that morning from the hotel door had been bogus enough, but the two men that returned were genuine desperados itching to get a shot at England. We spent the evening piling up evidence in our favour. Some kind of republic had been started in Portugal, and ordinarily the cafes would have been full of politicians, but the war had quieted all these local squabbles, and the talk was of nothing but what was doing in France and Russia. The place we went to was a big, well-lighted show on a main street, and there was a lot of sharp-eyed fellows wandering about that I guessed were spies and police agents. I knew that Britain was one of the countries that doesn't bother about this kind of game, and it would be safe enough to let ourselves go. I talked Portuguese fairly well, and Peter spoke it like a Lourenco Marquis barkeeper, with a lot of shenanigan words to fill him. He started on curaco, which I reckoned was a new drink to him, and presently his tongue ran freely. Several neighbours pricked up their ears, and soon we had a small crowd round our table. We talked to each other of Maritz and our doings. It didn't seem to be a popular subject in that cafe. One big blue-black fellow said that Maritz was a dirty swine who would soon be hanged. Peter quickly caught his knife wrist with one hand and his throat with the other and demanded an apology. He got it. The Lisbon Boulevardiers have not lost any lions. After that, there was a bit of a squash in our corner. Those near to us were very quiet and polite, but the outer fringe made remarks. When Peter said that if Portugal, which he admitted he loved, was going to stick to England, she was backing the wrong horse. There was a murmur of disapproval. One decent-looking fellow, who had the air of a ship's captain, flushed all over his honest face and stood up looking straight at Peter. I saw that we had struck an Englishman and mentioned it to Peter in Dutch. Peter played his part perfectly. He suddenly shut up and, with a furtive look around him, began to jabber to me in a low voice. He was the very picture of the old stage conspirator.
The old fellow stood up, staring at us. "I don't very well understand this damned lingo," he said. "But if so be you dirty Dutchmen are saying anything against England, I'll ask you to repeat it. And if so be as you repeats it, I'll take either of you on and knock the face off him." He was a chap after my own heart, but I had to keep up the game. I said in Dutch to Peter that we mustn't get brawling in a public house. "Remember the big thing," I said darkly. Peter nodded, and the old fellow, after staring at us for a bit, spat scornfully and walked out. "The time is coming when the Englander will sing small," I observed to the crowd. We stood drinks to one or two, and then swaggered into the street. At the door, a hand touched my arm, and looking down, I saw a little scrap of a man in a fur coat. "Will the gentleman walk a step with me and drink a glass of beer?" he said in a very stiff Dutch. "Who the devil are you?" I asked. "Gott straft England," was his answer, and turning back the lapel of his coat, he showed some kind of ribbon in his buttonhole. "Amen," said Peter. "Lead on, friend, we don't mind if we do." He led us to a back street, and then up two pairs of stairs to a very snug little flat. The place was filled with fine red lacquer, and I guessed that art dealing was his normal business. Portugal, since the Republic broke up the convents and sold up the big royalist grandees, was full of bargains in the lacquer and curio line. He filled us two long tankards of very good Munich beer. "Prosit," he said, raising his glass. "You are from South Africa. What make you in Europe?" We both looked sullen and secretive. "That's our own business," I answered. "You don't expect to buy our confidence with a glass of beer." "So," he said, "then I will put it differently. From your speech in the cafe, I judge you not to love the English." Peter said something about stamping on their grandmothers, a Kaffir phrase which sounded gruesome in Dutch. The man laughed. "That is all I want to know. You are on the German side?" "That remains to be seen," I said. "If they treat me fair, I'll fight for them, or for anybody else that makes war on England. England has stolen my country, and corrupted my people, and made me an exile. We Afrikaners do not forget. We may be slow, but we win in the end. We are two men worth a great price. Germany fights England in East Africa. We know the natives as no Englishman can ever know them. They are too soft and easy, and the Kaffirs laugh at them. But we can handle the blacks so that they will fight like devils for fear of us. What is the reward, little man, for our services? I will tell you, there will be no reward. We ask none. We fight for hate of England." Peter grunted a deep approval. "That is good talk," said our entertainer, and his close-set eyes flashed. "There is room in Germany for such men as you. Where are you going now, I beg to know?" "To Holland," I said, "and then maybe we go to Germany. We are tired with travel and may rest a bit. This war will last long and our chance will come." "But you may miss your market," he said significantly. "A ship sails tomorrow for Rotterdam. If you take my advice, you will go with her." This was what I wanted. For if we stayed in Lisbon, some real soldier of Maritz might drop in any day and blow the gaff. "I recommend you to sail in the Mikado," he repeated. "There is work for you in Germany. Oh yes, much work. But if you delay, the chance may pass. I'll arrange your journey. It's my business to help allies of my fatherland." He wrote down our names and an epitome of our doings contributed by Peter, who required two mugs of beer to help him through. He was a Bavarian, it seemed, and we drank to the health of Prince Ruprecht, the same blighter I was trying to do in at Lewes. There was an irony which Peter, unfortunately, could not appreciate. If he could, he would have enjoyed it. The little chap saw us back to our hotel, and was with us the next morning after breakfast bringing the steamer tickets. We got on board about 2 in the afternoon, but on my advice, he did not see us off. I told him that, being British subjects and rebels at that, we did not want to run any risks on board, assuming a British cruiser caught up with us and searched us. But Peter took £20 off him for travelling expenses, it being his rule never to miss an opportunity of spoiling the Egyptians. As we were dropping down the Tagus, we passed the old Henry the Navigator.
"I met Sloggett in the street this morning," said Peter, "and he told me a little German man had been off in a boat at daybreak, looking up the passenger list. Yon was a right notion of yours, Cornelius. I'm glad we're going amongst the Germans. They're careful people, whom it is a pleasure to meet."
Today's music is a 1921 track by Mary Stafford. It's called "I'm Going to Jazz My Way."
And now it's time to see what the old reanimator is up to. Part 2. The Plague Demon. I shall never forget that hideous summer 16 years ago, when like a noxious affright from the halls of Eblis, typhoid stalked leeringly through Arkham. It is by that satanic scourge that most recall the year, for truly terror brooded with bat wings over the piles of coffins in the tombs of Christchurch Cemetery. Yet for me, there is a greater horror in that time. A horror known to me alone, now that Herbert West has disappeared. West and I were doing postgraduate work in summer classes at the Medical School of Miskatonic University. And my friend had attained a wide notoriety because of his experiments leading towards the revivification of the dead. After the scientific slaughter of uncounted small animals, the freakish work had ostensibly stopped by order of our sceptical dean, Dr. Alan Halsey, though West had continued to perform certain secret tests in his dingy boarding house room and had, on one terrible and unforgettable occasion, taken a human body from its grave in the Potter's Field to a deserted farmhouse beyond Meadow Hill.
I was with him on that odious occasion, and saw him inject into the still veins the elixir which he thought would to some extent restore life's chemical and physical processes. It had ended horribly, in a delirium fear which we gradually came to attribute to our own overwrought nerves, and West had never afterward been able to shake off a maddening sensation of being hunted or haunted. The body had not been quite fresh enough. It is obvious that to restore normal mental attributes, a body must be very fresh indeed. And the burning of the old house had prevented us from burying the thing. It would have been better if we could have known it was underground. After that experience, West had dropped his researches for some time. But as the zeal of the born scientist slowly returned, he again became importunate with the college faculty, pleading for the use of the dissecting room and of fresh human specimens for the work he regarded as so overwhelmingly important. His pleas, however, were wholly in vain, for the decision of Dr. Halsey was inflexible, and the other professors all endorsed the verdict of their leader. In the radical theory of reanimation, they saw nothing but the immature vagaries of a youthful enthusiast whose slight form, yellow hair and spectacled blue eyes, and soft voice, gave no hint of the supernormal, almost diabolical power of the cold brain within. I can see him now, as he was then, and I shiver. He grew sterner of face, but never elderly. And now Sefton Asylum has had the mishap, and West has vanished. West clashed disagreeably with Dr. Halsey near the end of our last undergraduate term, in a wordy dispute that did less credit to him than the kindly dean in point of courtesy. He felt that he was needlessly and irrationally retarded in a supremely great work. A work which he could, of course, conduct to suit himself in later years, but which he wished to begin while still possessed of the exceptional faculties of the university. That the tradition-bound elders should ignore his singular results on animals and persist in their denial of the possibility of reanimation was inexpressibly disgusting and almost incomprehensible to a youth of West's logical temperament. Only greater maturity could help him understand the chronic mental limitations of the professor-doctor type, the product of generations of pathetic puritanism. Kindly, conscientious, and sometimes gentle and amiable, yet always narrow, intolerant, custom-ridden, and lacking in perspective. Age has more charity for those incomplete yet high-souled characters, whose worst real vice is timidity, and who are ultimately punished by general ridicule for their intellectual sins. Sins like Ptolemaism, Calvinism and anti-Darwinism, anti-Nietism, and every sort of Sabbatarianism and sumptuary legislation. West, young despite his marvellous scientific acquirements, had scant patience with the good Dr. Halsey and his erudite colleagues, and nursed an increasing resentment coupled with a desire to prove his theories to these obtuse worthies in some striking and dramatic fashion. Like most youths, he indulged in elaborate daydreams of revenge, triumph, and final magnanimous forgiveness. And then had come the scourge, grinning and lethal from the nightmare caverns of Tartarus. West and I had graduated about the time of its beginning, but it remained for additional work at the summer school, so that we were in Arkham when it broke with full demonic fury upon the town. Though not as yet licensed physicians, we now had our degrees, and were pressed frantically into public service as the number of the stricken grew. The situation was almost past management, and deaths insured too frequently for the local undertakers fully to handle. Burials without embalming were made in rapid succession, and even the Christchurch Cemetery receiving tomb was crammed with coffins of the unembalmed dead. This circumstance was not without effect on West, who thought often of the irony of the situation. So many fresh specimens, yet none for his persecuted researches. We were frightfully overworked, and the terrific mental and nervous strain made my friend brood morbidly. But West's gentle enemies were no less harassed with prostrating duties.
college had all but closed, and every doctor of the medical faculty was helping to fight the typhoid plague. Dr. Halsey, in particular, had distinguished himself in sacrificing service, applying his extreme skill and wholehearted energy to cases which many others shunned because of the danger or apparent hopelessness. Before a month was over, the fearless dean had become a popular hero, though he seemed unconscious of his fame as he struggled to keep from collapsing with physical fatigue and nervous exhaustion. West would not withhold admiration for the fortitude of his foe, but because of this, was even more determined to prove to him the truth of his amazing doctrines. Taking advantage of the disorganization of both college work and the municipal health regulations, he managed to get a recently deceased body smuggled into the university dissecting room one night, and in my presence, injected a new modification of his solution. The thing actually opened its eyes, but only stared at the ceiling with a look of soul-petrifying horror before collapsing into an inertness from which nothing could rouse it. West said it was not fresh enough. The hot summer air does not favour corpses. That time we were almost caught before we incinerated the thing, and West doubted the advisability of repeating his daring misuse of the college laboratory. The peak of the epidemic was reached in August. West and I were almost dead, and Dr. Halsey did die on the 14th. The students all attended the hasty funeral on the 15th, and brought an impressive wreath, though the latter was quite overshadowed by the tribute sent by the wealthy Arkham citizens and by the municipality itself. It was almost a public affair, for the dean had surely been a public benefactor. After the entombment, we were all somewhat depressed, and spent the afternoon at the bar of the commercial house where West, though shaken by the death of his chief opponent, chilled the rest of us with references to his notorious theories. Most of the students went home or to various duties as the evening advanced, but West persuaded me to aid him in making a night of it. West's landlady saw us arrive at his room about 2 a.m. with a third man between us, and told her husband that we had all evidently dined and wined rather well. Apparently, this assiduous matron was right. For about 3 a.m, the whole house was aroused by cries coming from West's room, where, when they broke down the door, they found the two of us unconscious on the blood-stained carpet, beaten, scratched, and mauled, and with the broken remnants of West's bottles and instruments all around us. Only an open window told what had become of our assailant, and many wondered how he himself had fared after the terrific leap from the second story to the lawn which he must have made. There were some strange garments in the room, but West, upon regaining consciousness, said they did not belong to the stranger, but were specimens collected for bacteriological analysis in the course of investigations on the transmission of germ diseases. He ordered them burnt as soon as possible in the capacious fireplace. To the police, we both declared ignorance of our late companion's identity. He was, West nervously said, a congenial stranger whom we had met at some downtown bar of uncertain location. We'd all been rather jovial, and West and I did not wish to have our pugnacious companion hunted down. That same night saw the beginning of the second Arkham horror, the horror that to me eclipsed the plague itself. Christ Church Cemetery was the scene of a terrible killing. A watchman, having been clawed to death in a manner not only too hideous for description, but raising a doubt as to the human agency of the dead. The victim had been seen alive considerably after midnight. The dawn revealed the unutterable thing. The manager of a circus at the neighbouring town of Bolton was questioned, but he swore that no beast had at any time escaped from his cage. Those who found the body noted a trail of blood leading to the receiving tomb, where a small pool of red lay on the concrete floor just outside the gate. A fainter trail led away towards the woods, but it soon gave out. The next night, devils danced on the roofs of Arkham, and unnatural madness howled in the wind. through the fevered town had crept a curse which some said was greater than the plague, and which some whispered was the embodied demon soul of the plague itself. 8 houses were entered by a nameless thing which strewed red death in its wake. In all, 17 maimed and shapeless remnants of bodies were left behind by the voiceless, sadistic monster that crept abroad. A few persons had half seen it in the dark, and said it was white, like a malformed ape or an anthropomorphic fiend. It had not left behind quite all that it had attacked, for sometimes it must have been hungry. The number it had killed was 14. 3 of the bodies had been in stricken homes and had not been alive. On the third night, frantic bands of searchers led by the police captured it in a house on Crane Street near the Miskatonic campus. They'd organised the quest with care, keeping in touch by means of volunteer telephone stations. And when someone in the college district had reported hearing a scratching at a shuttered window, the net was quickly spread. On account of the general alarm and precautions, there were only 2 more victims, and the capture was effected without major casualties. The thing was finally stopped by a bullet, though not a fatal one, and was rushed to the local hospital amidst universal excitement and loathing. For it had been a man. This much was clear, despite the nauseous eyes, the voiceless simianism, and the demonic savagery. They dressed its wound and carted it to the asylum at Sefton, where it beat its head against the walls of a padded cell for 16 years, until the recent mishap, when it escaped under circumstances that few like to mention. What had most disgusted the searchers of Arkham was the thing they noticed when the monster's face was cleaned. The mocking, unbelievable resemblance to a learned and self-sacrificing martyr who had been entombed but 3 days before. The late Dr. Alan Halsey, public benefactor and dean of the medical school of the Miskatonic University. To the vanished Herbert West, and to me, the disgust and horror was supreme. I shudder tonight as I think of it, shudder even more than I did that morning when West muttered through his bandages, "Damn it, wasn't quite fresh enough." Well, that's it for today. The opening music was provided by Victor Valdez from The Simple Project, and this file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Until next time. CthulhuPodcast.co.uk